This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
I'm here too as a U.S. citizen who has witnessed tens of billions of U.S. tax dollars go to funding and arming a proxy war against Russia, while people in the U.S., ordinary people, suffer from rising levels of poverty, homelessness, suicide, and economic insecurity.
Left Lens host Danny Haifong addressed the UN Security Council about the dangerous U.S. escalation of the Ukraine war.
Name AUKUS is not an accurate reflection of whose it benefits. It primarily benefits the USA, it benefits the UK, and Australia's interests are coming a long way third.
AUKUS, the Australia-UK-US military alliance, is expanding its presence in Australia.
The Texas legislature, under Republican leadership, they're not even hiding the ball anymore. No, they're passing laws now that don't even apply to the entire state of Texas, that apply just to Harris County.
With 4 million people, Harris County, Texas is the state's largest county. State Republican leaders are scheming to control its local elections.
Along comes a Trump indictment to seal the deal and divert people's attention away from these important issues that if people looked at, they would question the system, they question the Biden presidency, and so, of course, we get endless Trump coverage.
Former president and Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump has now been criminally indicted 4 times. The latest indictment is no cause for celebration, according to Black Agenda Report's Margaret Kimberly. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Speaking at the August 17 meeting of the UN Security Council, journalist and geopolitical analyst Danny Haifong explained the dangers that Western arms flows to Ukraine pose to international peace and stability.
Members of the Council, Mr. President, today I am here as a journalist who has dedicated the last 10 years of my life writing about and speaking out against the long record of human rights abuses and war crimes committed by my country of birth, the United States. I don't consider this a hobby or even a profession, but rather a duty to all of humanity and those who want to see a better and more peaceful future. I am here too as a U.S. citizen who has witnessed tens of billions of U.S. tax dollars go to funding and arming a proxy war against Russia, while people in the U.S., ordinary people, suffer from rising levels of poverty, homelessness, suicide, and economic insecurity. As Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1958, true peace is not merely the absence of tension, but the presence of justice. On June 2, 2023, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken gave a speech in Helsinki where he stated that military support for Ukraine must be prioritized over diplomacy. The argument goes that a steady supply of arms to Ukraine will turn the tide on the battlefield and force Russia to the negotiating table. Blinken is supposed to be the U.S.'s top diplomat, not a champion of escalating conflict. However, the sentiment that he communicated has been a foundational feature of the justifications given for the West's continued flow of arms to Ukraine. The facts, however, undermine Blinken's assertions. First, U.S. and Western arms are anathema to resolving conflict. The U.S. is the biggest arms exporter in the world, comprising of around 40% of all global arms sales. These arms have been instrumental in the bloodiest wars of our last 2 generations, including the U.S.-led invasions of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria. U.S. arms play a major role in escalating tensions in the Korean Peninsula, and the military encirclement of Russia and China, which has ushered in a new Cold War and all of the risks that come with it. Second, it was never Russia that needed to be forced to the negotiating table. Back in December 2021, if we remember, Russia provided draft proposals of security guarantees to the U.S. and to NATO that were meant to serve as the basis of dialogue and negotiation. They were summarily rejected. By late January 2022, the U.S. announced 200,000 pounds of what was deemed quote-unquote lethal aid to Ukraine in an obvious signal of escalation. In April 2022, both U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin traveled to Ukraine just weeks after a peace deal fell through and admitted that the U.S. was all in on winning the current fight in Ukraine. What they meant by this was that the U.S. was fully committed to corralling its own military arsenal and that of its NATO partners in a proxy war against Russia to the last Ukrainian. The absence of diplomacy in times of conflict cannot but lead to escalation. That Russia's security, and for that matter, the security of the entire world, has been dismissed so summarily by the West is proof enough that the ceaseless supply of arms to Ukraine endangers peace. Weapons to Ukraine do not represent some kind of quote-unquote arsenal of democracy, as some in the U.S. foreign policy establishment tout. NATO countries have already provided $40 billion in weapons to Ukraine over the span of this conflict, and we have witnessed these weapons become heavier, deadlier, and more provocative, stymieing the possibility of a negotiated settlement to this conflict. Many of these weapons have landed on the black market to drug cartels, criminal organizations, and indeed, neo-Nazi and fascist elements, many of which now make up parts of Ukraine's armed forces. Furthermore, NATO has essentially armed Ukrainian army after Ukrainian army at the expense of its own arsenal. The New York Times sounded the alarm 8 months ago that Ukraine is now the location of an artillery and tank war, the likes of which the West was not prepared to fight long term. And if this is the case, then rational minds may assume that the West would cease its supply of deadly weaponry. But the opposite has occurred. The U.S. approved of sending cluster munitions to Ukraine last month, the same munitions that continue to kill and explode on civilians in Laos decades after the U.S. invasion there, and which have long been condemned by over 100 countries worldwide. I'm a journalist and a geopolitical analyst, not a military expert. But such experts in recent months have come clean about the limitations of Western firepower. Camille Grand, former Assistant Secretary General of Defense Investment at NATO, stated that, quote, a day in Ukraine is a month or more in Afghanistan, end quote. She is referencing the fact that Ukraine burns through nearly half of the artillery produced in the United States in a single day, per month in a single day. Former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, James Stravitis, acknowledged last May that analysts were correct to assume that Ukraine is burning through a year's worth of U.S. production monthly. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and U.S. President Joe Biden have both acknowledged these weapons shortages, with Biden admitting during his announcement of cluster munitions for Ukraine that, quote, this is a war relating to munitions, and they're running out of ammunition, and we're low on it, end quote. And I'm not even touching on issues of personnel, training, and other logistical items here. All of these problems have come to a head as the last several months saw Ukraine's spring counteroffensive gain much discussion. For months, political and military officials in the West regularly broadcasted to media outlets of an oncoming victorious offensive that would take large amounts of territory from Russia. Yet at the same time, Ukraine, and in particular its head of state, Volodymyr Zelensky, repeatedly demanded that the West increase its supply of heavy weaponry, including air power. Zelensky has blamed over and over the West for its lackluster supply of arms in conjunction with the months-long delay of this counteroffensive against Russia. Now, this counteroffensive is in its third month, and the results have been disastrous. Around 30% of NATO's weapon supplies to Ukraine have been destroyed. The death toll on the battlefield is staggering. An estimated 43,000 Ukrainian forces have been killed, and reports are surfacing that local morgues in Ukraine are seeing nearly double the bodies since the counteroffensive began. And for what? The optimism of Western officials and diplomats has waned, with many now acknowledging that Ukraine has not even penetrated Russia's first defensive line. So I think the better question then is cui bono, who benefits and what benefits from Western arms being poured into Ukraine? Certainly not Ukraine if the results of the counteroffensive and the conflict as a whole are the measure. And it certainly isn't global peace instability either. for all the benefits that come from an emerging multipolar world. The incessant militarization of Ukraine pushed by the West is helping fuel a worldwide economic slowdown and the potential of major power conflict, which could very well take on a nuclear character. So a simple answer to this question is the arms industry, the corporations that have profited mightily from this conflict. Shareholders of the largest military contractors are being paid handsomely since the conflict began as profits soar. The top 25 Western military contractors have seen their revenues increase by 11% over the past year to $212 billion. Arms sales are expected to increase to $450 billion in total by the end of 2023, an increase of $47 billion thanks to the Ukraine conflict. This bonanza in arms sales is thus making the slim minority of the richest people richer, while the rest of the world is left to resolve the myriad of problems left in the wake of this conflict. One of the primary responsibilities of the United Nations Security Council, as stated by the UN Charter, is the maintenance of international peace and stability. Ongoing Western arms sales to Ukraine are not only a violation of the UN Charter, but they also reveal the geopolitical realities that undergird this conflict. Indeed, it would be simplistic to claim that profits alone from Western arms sales are what is driving a wedge in the cause of peace. The United States, where I reside, has a long record of waging unilateral military conflict on a global scale in contravention of the UN Charter, with 800 plus foreign military bases, 11 command structures, and a public military budget of nearly $1 trillion U.S. dollars. There is now an open conflict within the U.S. foreign policy establishment over whether Ukraine and arming Ukraine to maximum effect is a good idea, or whether other military matters deserve more attention, with a leaked memo from top Air Force brass claiming that the U.S. must prepare to go to war with China by 2025. So Ukraine thus finds itself in the eye of a much larger storm, that of a policy, a U.S. policy, of great power competition, or what is better termed great power confrontation, led by the United States. Peace and stability is not possible so long as the West pursues a foreign policy of unilateral interventionism in Ukraine to fulfill a larger goal, a larger geopolitical goal of unipolarity. This policy runs completely counter to the principles of the UN Charter. The continued flow of arms to Ukraine is a violation of Article 2, Section 3 of this charter, requiring member states to resolve conflict in a peaceful manner, and these arms only prolong the conflict with devastating consequences. The U.S. and its Western partners and whoever goes along with it must learn to operate within the framework of international law, just like all other member states, or the world will face the continued threat of instability and war, no matter the efforts of this Security Council and other United Nations bodies.
That was journalist Danny Haifong addressing the UN Security Council.
Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. The ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard of some and all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitaries. They took the secrets from the secretary, but they left the an obituary. The military and the monetary from thousands of miles away in a Saudi Arabian sanctuary had us all scrambling for our...
That was Gil Scott-Heron, Worked for Peace. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ian Garrison. While President Biden this past week was announcing the formation of a new military alliance between the U.S., Japan, and Korea, very few Americans were aware of the heightened U.S. militarization of Australia. According to labor and community activists, the Australia-UK-US military alliance, known as AUKUS, is turning Australia into a military fortress state. Under the AUKUS umbrella, the U.S. is planning to build a major nuclear submarine base in the port of Kembla in Australia. Shiri Winton is with the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network. She spoke to Pacifica about the way President Biden and a bipartisan Congress are pushing for war in Asia.
So Australia is just completely being enmeshed and into what's called interoperability and interchangeability into the US military agenda in the Asia Pacific, but also around the world. And it even goes to the point of that Australia is now advocating and implementing the US global policies, the US rules-based global policies. So we've seen the Australian government follow, and it's a Labor government, supposedly progressive government, doing the bidding for the US in the Asia Pacific and particularly around the Pacific nations, and that's a further development. So in Australia, as well as IPAN, there's been an upsurge of opposition to AUKUS. So when AUKUS was announced and a nationwide Australian anti-AUKUS coalition was formed, it's in every state. There are a lot of activism, there are a lot of public forums, rallies. It's been an upsurge of opposition to AUKUS and nuclear submarines, with people calling for the cancelling of AUKUS, cancelling of nuclear submarines. It reaches all the corners of society to the point that the Australian Labor Party, the rank and file, large sections of the rank and file, are in rebellion. So they're passing branches, rank and file branches, are passing motions, are calling on the government, on the Labor government, terminate the AUKUS and terminate the nuclear submarines. Finally, look, I just want to say, and Kevin will talk about that no doubt much more, is that our big concern is that Australia's sovereignty is being completely wiped out with an obsequious government. America is very much dictating our foreign policies. It's dictating our defence. Our defence is absolutely integrated into the US military. Our concern is that we're going to become another Okinawa and Guam. And all this is building up towards a war with China.
That was Shiri Winton of the Independent and Peaceful Australian Network. Kevin Bracken, past chair of the Victoria Melbourne Maritime Union of Australia, also spoke to Pacifica about how the U.S. is forcing its junior partner Australia into an expensive military alliance.
Yeah, I was the past secretary of the Victorian branch of the Maritime Union. I've always been a labor activist and also calling for peace. And we had the motto that peace is union business. I'd like to talk about, you know, Australia first, and just to maybe go back in time, mention a name which you might be familiar with as Marshall Green, also known as the Coup Master, who was the American ambassador in South Korea when there was a coup there, when the only free parliamentary party was overturned. He later came to Indonesia. And Indonesia, at the time, had the largest Communist Party outside the USA and USSR, but it also had President Sukarno, who was the leader of the Non-Aligned Movement, which was a group of 140 nations which neither followed either side in the Cold War. He did not follow. When he came, produced his credentials to the Indonesian government, he was met with a huge anti-Vietnam War demonstration under the slogan, "Go Home Green." But within a few months of that year, six generals were murdered, and General Suharto took over control from Sukarno and started a purge that killed between 500,000 and 2 million people from lists compiled by the CIA. A good book on it is Battleground Indonesia, JFK versus Zell and Dulles. But he later came to Australia and was the ambassador to Australia in 1973. In 1972 in Australia, Gough Whitlam was elected the first Labor Prime Minister in 23 years. Within 12 months, he'd withdrawn Australian troops from Vietnam, ended military conscription, started Medicare, which gave universal health cover for everyone, started free university education, legal aid, which gave legal aid to anyone who couldn't afford it. He recognised mainland China in the One China policy and opened up an embassy in Hanoi and recognised Cuba. He proposed to borrow money from the OPEC countries, which were awash with petrodollars at the time, and buy back the foreign ownership of our minerals. He also threatened not to renew the Pine Gap, which Shirley spoke about earlier, which is an important military installation. He was very disappointed that he believed that it had been used in mining of Haiphong Harbour and the bombing of Cambodia. And he also called for a list of all the people working for the CIA in Australia. On November 11th that year, 1975, in an unprecedented move, the Governor-General, who was supposed to be a superficial, just a figurehead in Australian politics and never previously played any other role than the rubber stamp legislation passed through Parliament, he sacked Gough Whitlam. He installed Malcolm Fraser as a caretaker government, and at a later election, with work done through Nugenham Bank and a number of other CIA agencies here, the government was not elected, and the rest is history. But I just wanted to go over this to let you know that not all the USA doesn't only overthrow third world governments that are at a contrary to US interests, but also to point out that there was a difference between political parties in Australia at the time. Unfortunately, that is not the case today. AUKUS, which was proposed by the Liberal Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, when his fortunes were lacking, was supported bipartisanly with the USA, with the Australian Labor Party. We had a Labor Party had opposed the Vietnam War. They supported the war in Afghanistan. They opposed the war in Iraq. They supported, unfortunately, the war against Syria, which Australia took part in as well. And now Australia has bipartisan support between both major parties with all the way to the USA. And unfortunately, the name AUKUS is not an accurate reflection of whose it benefits. It primarily benefits the USA. It benefits the UK. And Australia's interests are coming a long way third. So it should probably be called US-UKA, you sucker, because that is all too true about what it means to Australia. The cost of the nuclear submarines, which is the first pillar of AUKUS, is $368 billion. That's equivalent to $35 million every day for 29 years. And as every major defence purchase has gone over budget, including things like the Joint Strike Fighter by as much as 80%, it'll all cost a lot more than that. AUKUS also builds up the US and the UK industrial capacity at the expense of Australia's. In 2000, manufacturing made up for 11.5% of our GDP. In 2022, it only accounted for 5.5%. Australia was one of the only countries that actually give up our own car manufacturing. And if you want to buy in a car in Australia now, you've got to be prepared to wait between 3 months and 18 months, and the price keeps going up as you're waiting. It will do nothing to protect our 34,000 kilometres of coastline. Australian industry has been cast aside, and we're dependent on the USA for equipment supply and maintenance. It also puts us at odds with our neighbours, in particular our largest trading partner, China. China currently buys a third of all Australian exports and is a top overseas market for many Australian goods and services. Even the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade states that the two economies are highly complementary and provide a broad range of opportunities for two-way trade and investment. The major exports are iron ore, natural gas and gold. In 2020, it was worth $271 billion. And while I don't support everything that the Chinese government does, you have to recognise that over the last 40 years, it's pulled 800 million people out of poverty. Any study of China's history will recognise the way the West treated China over the last 100 since the 1850s. China calls it 100 years of humiliation. And it began with the British correcting a trade imbalance with China by importing opium from India and making the people addicted to it. There was three opium wars. But you could compare that with life expectancy in China now. It's now longer than someone born in the USA. Also, they go on about the Chinese, how it's a heavily prison system. And currently, there's 121 people per 100,000 in jail in China. In the USA, there's 671 people per 100,000. But it's not only China it puts us at odds with, it's also our more direct neighbours like Indonesia and Malaysia, and also our nations in the Pacific. 40 years ago, on August the 6th, on Hiroshima Day, Australia signed the Rarotonga Treaty with the Pacific Island nations that established a nuclear-free, weapons-free zone. The USA, the UK and France have detonated over 318 nuclear devices in the Pacific. And as Bevan Ramsden said in Bells and Invitations, AUKUS has not only made a mockery of our sovereignty by allowing nuclear-capable military assets to be based on our shores without any parliamentary debate, let alone public debate or consultation, it is making a mockery of our neighbours in the Pacific.
That was Kevin Bracken, past chair of the Victoria Melbourne Maritime Union of Australia.
I'm a living sunset, lightning in my bones. It pushed me to the edge, but my will is stone. Cause I believe in a better way. Fools will be fools and wise will be wise, but I will look this world straight in the
was Ben Harper, Better Way. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. On July 26, the government of Niger was overthrown in a bloodless coup led by Presidential Guard Commander Abdourahamane Tchiani. The coup leaders declared that they had taken power to end French neocolonialism, and huge crowds have repeatedly filled the streets and the stadium of the country's capital, Niamey, in support of the coup. France and the U.S. have tried to prod ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, into invading Niger to put President Mohamed Bazoum back in power. But Bazoum's election was disputed, and he seems to have next to no popular support. Nigeria's defense chief and its parliament have both opposed an invasion of Niger, and an ECOWAS invasion would be impossible without Nigeria, the most populous nation in West Africa. Mali and Burkina Faso have also said that they would consider an invasion of Niger like an invasion of their own territory. Niger's new prime minister, Ali Lamine Zeine, spoke to Deutsche Welle about prospects for peace.
As prime minister, and considering the sanctions imposed on Niger by ECOWAS, are you worried about the way things are being managed?
Why should we be worried? A human life is made up of challenges. And even though it's an unfair challenge imposed on us, we think we can tackle it, and we will. There is no fear from our point of view. The people of Niger are determined. I think that under the leadership of our entire people, but above all with God's help, we'll make it.
You welcomed a delegation from Nigeria. Are negotiations with ECOWAS, or at least the beginning of negotiations, underway?
Even before the delegation came, the head of state made it clear that he was open to negotiations. What interest does he have in closing himself off to any initiative that serves our people? To deal with this challenge imposed on us, he said we should sit down for negotiations. This delegation that has come, you saw, they are the greatest theologians of Nigeria and even of the continent. This comforts us. It comforts us because they represent the behavior of Nigerian society. Beyond that, you even have the Nigerian parliamentarians who got together and they clearly stated they opposed any attack on our country. But it's not just the parliamentarians and the theologians. You also have the Nigerian population and business people. We've heard from most of them. And that's comforting because our biggest neighbor is Nigeria, with a 1,500 kilometer border, a shared border, from Difa to Zinder, Tawa, Dosu. And I haven't forgotten Maradi. The populations on both sides are all the same. We are interested in working to safeguard this relationship, which is extremely important and historic. Certainly, ECOWAS can work on economic issues. Firstly, because the fundamental principle of solidarity is to enable all the states that have accepted this integration to create the conditions for wealth and distribute it everywhere. Moreover, to ensure that each country benefits from this solidarity. If, instead of this economic solidarity, the political and military principles take precedence, we can only regret it. But then again, in Niger, we have a tradition of humility. God made Nigerians pacifist and peaceful. We would like to see a solution found very quickly so that our country can return to normal life.
That was Niger's new Prime Minister, Ali Lamine Zein, on hopes for peace in the West African nation. Why are red states passing voting restriction laws to disrupt the voting process in blue counties? Texas Senate Bill 1750 would abolish election administration oversight in Harris County, the largest county in Texas, which is majority black and brown. Harris County Attorney Christian Menefee says that for nearly 100 years, the Texas Constitution has prohibited the state legislature from passing laws applying to only one locale, but the new Texas Senate Bill 1750 would. Here's Menefee in conversation with former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke on O'Rourke's Instagram Live webcast, Front Lines of the Fight for Democracy.
You know, I come from a two-parent household where both folks served in the armed forces. And, you know, both my mother and my father got into the military to escape poverty. So I grew up my entire life kind of having this sense of duty for public service, where I was taught that it's not enough to sit on the sidelines and talk about the democracy that you want. You got to get in and actively be involved in protecting that democracy. And I think what really woke me up, Beto, was in 2016, after having been the first in my family to graduate college, been part of a family where I had a brother who had childhood cancer and made it through that. And we had a single income because my mom was back and forth to the hospital all the time. I graduate college, I go to law school, and I started practicing out in the private sector because, yeah, I grew up in a household where we didn't have much money, so the opportunity to make money was a big deal to me. And in 2016, I remember vividly when Donald Trump won the presidential election. I remember thinking, there's no way that it was my path to come up in that household to learn about the protection of our democracy, to be sitting on the sidelines in one of the most pivotal moments in our country's history. So I started getting more involved, started getting involved in civic organizations and democratic clubs to do my part in shaping the democracy that I wanted to see. And that's when I learned about this office, the county attorney's office. I love being a lawyer. When I was growing up, I didn't see any lawyers. I didn't know any lawyers. So to have become a lawyer, I loved doing it. And I knew that I wanted to get into public service, but I wanted to keep practicing law. So I saw this position that previously, not much had been made of it, right? It's basically the civil lawyer for Harris County government, which has about 18,000 employees. And so you think of it like an in-house legal department. But what I saw at the same time, Beto, was Greg Abbott, Ken Paxton, and other Republican leaders really taking aim at Harris County, filing lawsuits, trying to undermine our elections. You even saw the President of the United States calling for an election audit right here in Harris County. And it was at that moment that I realized that we needed somebody in this role who was going to be prepared to go fight it out in the courtroom with those folks, who wasn't going to be afraid of them, who was going to call bullshit when he saw it. And that was part of the reason that I decided to jump in and run for this position.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like to live there, to work there. What makes Harris County, Houston so special? And that might lead us into why it has become target number one in Texas for those trying to stop people from freely and fairly voting and deciding the outcomes of these elections.
Most folks don't know this, but Harris County is the third most populous county in the country, right? And it's huge. If Harris County were a state, it'd be the 25th most populous state, and it'd be the size of one of, you know, several states on the East Coast. It's just this huge land mass that has a ton of people. But what most people don't know is we're incredibly diverse. There's over 100 languages spoken in the Houston area. We have this incredibly diverse food scene, cultural scene, right? And it's funny because whenever I talk to my friends from law school who live in Chicago and New York and LA, they just think, oh, Christian lives in Texas, right? They don't understand that when you live in Houston, you're experiencing something different than maybe other parts of Texas would experience. But at the same time that you're having this incredible diversity in Harris County, you're having diverse leaders who are being elected, right? In 2015, we elected our second African-American mayor, Sylvester Turner. Fast forward a couple years later, you saw Rodney Ellis get elected to the commissioner's court. Fast forward 2 years later, you see Adrian Garcia and Lena Hidalgo get elected. And Lena's now our chief executive officer for Harris County. That's a young Latina who was under the age of 30 at the time she was elected. Then 2 years later, I get elected. So we have a black person running the city, black and brown folk running the county, a black elections administrator, a black county clerk, a black county attorney. And at the same time, our viewpoints are more progressive than those folks out in Austin. So what you're seeing is this old institutional guard, politicians who are known across the nation, like Ken Paxton, who filed the lawsuit to overturn the results of the 2020 election, Dan Patrick, who's one of Donald Trump's closest allies, Greg Abbott, who's now trying to stand in to run for president himself. You're seeing these old institutional players bump up against young, diverse, progressive leadership that I would say better reflects the third largest county in the country than the folks out in Austin.
Tell us why you think, and then we'll get into the ways in which they're doing this, there is such a concerted, focused attack on Harris County, and specifically the people and the voters in Harris County.
After the 2020 presidential election, you saw our former president step in and say that the results weren't true, that he actually won. And what I saw was a person clamoring to hold on to power after the decision had already been made to put him out of power. But in Texas, our politicians on the Republican side who are running the state, they're trying to prevent it beforehand, right? They're trying to avoid ending up in a Donald Trump situation. And the way that they see to do that is you suppress votes in the large Democratic diverse areas. You undermine elected officials in the large diverse Democratic areas. So it's a long-term strategy to ensure that Texas continues to elect Republicans statewide, because anybody who's paying attention who looks at the demographic data knows that with the trends in demographic data, if everybody plays their cards right, Texas should be blue in the near future, right? If, let's say, the next decade, right? As long as we address the tough issues, the issues that are people's front door, we will turn blue. The Republicans see that, and they understand that there are certain counties in Texas that if you can impact elections there, you have the ability to retain power for several decades more, or maybe even several years more. So that attention is directed to Harris County, and they do it in a few ways. They undermine the right to vote. They try to restrict voting in a way that they know will disproportionately impact Harris County. But another important way that they do it is they attack the leaders in these areas, right? And this is an old playbook, right? I mean, there are many books out there that talk about Confederates and how they're still fighting the Civil War from years ago. And one of the best known strategies is you immediately make black and brown politicians look corrupt, right? You look for anything that's out there and you immediately try to label them corrupt for doing the same thing that other politicians do, right? You try to restrict them and then argue that they're ineffective after you've restricted them. You, in any way you can, demonize them, because in turn, what you're doing is making a certain base believe that these people are not capable to be good leaders and allows you to retain power. I think it's a very coordinated effort, and I think it's the reason why you see these attacks only on the counties that are reliably blue, and those that are competing right now are purple, and the Republicans are trying to keep them red.
The Republican leadership, it sounds like from your description, understand what's happening presently in Texas in terms of the disconnect between public policy at a statewide level and the real values and interests and aspirations of the people of Texas at large, and specifically where you have the greatest concentration of people, which is in Harris County in Houston, Texas. There's been this concerted effort to stop people from voting, from being part of the electorate. I have reminded people that when you see lines that stretch 6-7 hours long outside of Texas Southern University, which is one of the places I last saw you before the November 22 election. That 6-hour line in part inspires, you know, admiration from those of us who are impressed that somebody would wait or could wait 6 hours in order to cast their ballot and participate in this democracy. But that feeling should quickly be overcome with shame that we force that indignity on anyone. And when you look at the facts and see that Republicans have closed down more than 700 polling locations in Texas, more than any other state, most of them concentrated in the fastest growing Black and Brown neighborhoods. When you look at our voter ID laws that again are focused on the very young, the very old, the poor, and again, communities of color across the state of Texas, a gerrymander of our congressional districts that has been described by three federal judges as a racial gerrymander of the state. That was the status quo before Republicans focused even harder on the constituents that you represent right now. So I'd love to transition into, to the degree that you can speak about this, and we'll respect the boundaries that you set because these are active cases right now. But the state legislature in this last legislative session, as they did in the prior one, tried to make it even harder for people in Harris County to vote. So one of the things that they've tried to do is to remove local control of elections and then to allow the state potentially to take over those elections completely. The other thing that's happening, and you alluded to this earlier, is those who lost local elections in 2022 in Harris County, who happen to be Republicans, are trying to overturn those elections through the courts and the legal system. You're at the forefront of both of these fights, which again come down to whether or not the right to vote and votes already cast will be respected. Can you tell us what's happening, what your role and the role of your office is, and what we might expect to see next in these fights?
That's right. So there are two different fights that are going on. The first is 22 losing Republican candidates from the 2022 election filed election contests to overturn the results of their election. What's notable is more than 10 of these folks filed their election contest, and I'm not making this up, on January 6th, the two-year anniversary of when a bunch of folks tried to storm the Capitol. Many of these races where these election contests have been filed are more than 10,000, 20,000 vote differentials, right? These are people who so clearly and obviously lost their races that there's no reasonable argument that they should be entitled to a new election. But they filed these lawsuits, and what they've done is they then push out a narrative to the media, right, to get them to continue to talk about elections in Harris County. So we're now in August of 2023 still talking about elections from 2022. Right now, closing arguments are going on in the first of those cases, and I have my team of lawyers are down there right now because we were really the repository for all the evidence, right? We put up, we have witnesses who were called in the case. We, all the documents came from the county. So we're actively watching it, and we've been involved in the process from day one. I'm hopeful that the judge in the case is going to see the facts as they are and is gonna throw this out. But the real important takeaway here is not what's happening today, but what's going to happen tomorrow. This is part of the new playbook, right? You lie to win, but if you don't win, then you just try to get the results thrown out after the fact. So it is a new strategy, and they can use their mega donors to fund legal counsel to be able to continuously bring these types of cases. It's a very dangerous thing, but I'm hopeful that the court system will boot this stuff out. But the other important lawsuit that we have is the Texas legislature this last session passed a law that abolished only one office in the entire state of Texas, and that is the Harris County Elections Administrator Office. They targeted Harris County, and it will only ever apply to Harris County forever. It only abolishes that office. Thankfully, there's a provision in the Texas Constitution that says you can't pass laws that target a locality. So we filed a lawsuit to boot that law out. Now, this is something that since I've gotten in office, right, anytime they file a law that impacts Harris County and I have good grounds to sue, I'm suing because I think it's important that we realize that over time, Democrats, I think, have gotten worn down, right? We like to think that everybody's better angels will win the arguments in their mind. We think that we can collaborate with conspirators. We think that if we just continue reaching across the aisle, then they'll work with us, right? If we just be nicer, they will give us voting rights. That's not how major movements have happened in this country, right? Thurgood Marshall was not asking permission. Folks who marched in the street in Selma were not asking permission. And I view part of my role as the young Democratic elected official to be prepared for a fight, And so anytime there's an opportunity for us to preserve elections, for us to preserve democracy, there's a fight. Just this week, several lawyers on my team and I were in Austin on the initial hearing in that case. We argued before the judge, and we expect an initial decision on that case tomorrow. But I think it's important to note that the Texas legislature, under Republican leadership, they're not even hiding the ball anymore, right? They're not now coming out and saying, oh, we're going to pass this law that we know is going to impact our most diverse county, but we're not going to call it that. No, they're passing laws now that don't even apply to the entire state of Texas, that apply just to Harris County. But the good news is my team is whip smart. We get up in the morning to work out. We eat our Wheaties, and we're prepared for a fight with Ken Paxton, Greg Abbott, Donald Trump, or whoever else may bring it.
That was Harris County Attorney Christian Menefee in conversation with former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke on Instagram Live. Texas Judge Karen Crump of Travis County granted a temporary injunction to stop Texas Senate Bill 1750 from going into effect on September 1. This bill would force Harris County to eliminate its chief election official and give state officials more authority over elections there. The Attorney General of Texas appealed Crump's ruling to the Texas Supreme Court, but County Attorney Christian Menefee says that SB 1750 is unconstitutional because it applies to Harris County's majority black and brown populations exclusively. The state legislature also passed a law that allows the state takeover of the entire Houston Independent School District, the largest in Texas, because one of 276 schools failed. That was The Beatles' Come Together. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. According to Black Agenda Report executive editor Margaret Kimberly, the latest Donald Trump indictment is no cause for celebration. The oligarchs still rule. The criminal justice system that Trump now faces is still constructed to ensnare black people, and the democracy said to be protected by the indictments doesn't really exist. Kimberly discussed her article, Trump Indictment Distraction, with Dr. Wilmer Leone on Sputnik Radio's The Critical Hour.
There are many serious issues which demand our attention at the current moment. You talk about climate change. You say that there are more than 4 million Medicaid recipients who have lost coverage after COVID. Emergency programs ended, and the money is still available. The U.S. continues to send money to the black hole of Ukraine, while residents of Maui, Hawaii, struggle to survive after devastating wildfires. And the Biden administration dares to brag about a one-time payment of $700 to people who are now homeless, while the military-industrial complex is flush with a new infusion of $200 million. And Margaret, you mentioned Maui, and it took the president until yesterday to even talk about it. Margaret Kimberly.
Well, yes, because if he talks about it, then he has to talk about what the federal government is going to do to help these people. And the answer is not very much. People aren't doing well. Bidenomics is a flop. He did not do the things that most Democratic voters wanted him to do. And if he talks about Maui, it just exposes the hollowness of the promises and of the narrative of why he should be reelected.
So continue on with your piece as it relates to what we're seeing play itself out in terms of these indictments are more of a distraction because there are bigger fish to fry.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I was inspired to write this when I was at a friend's house and a captive audience. So I was watching MSNBC. If I'm watching MSNBC, you know, it's because I'm forced to. But at any rate, there were several shows and every single one talked about the indictment and nothing else. And it was interesting. And of course, that's the, you know, that network is the propaganda arm of the Democratic wing of the duopoly. So it's not surprising they would do that, but it tells us a lot. These indictments are the media coverage, the amount and the type of media coverage serve to distract people, to try to convince people that Donald Trump is still the boogeyman. Their problems are still because of Trump. The country was fine before Donald Trump. We had a democracy before Donald Trump. Donald Trump tried to destroy democracy. And in order to save this democracy that we don't really have, he has to be indicted numerous times now. It's the fourth indictment, and has to have the book thrown at him and his co-defendants. And there have to be RICO charges, and it has to be a state charge because he could not pardon himself and no other president could pardon him. And there is mandatory sentencing should he and others be found guilty. So I think these indictments of a former president are always political. And, you know, but with Trump, of course, he is responsible for much of his troubles. And he is in this case with the Georgia election charges. But the other things that we've mentioned are not going away, are causing great hardship to people. How can you not talk about the heat waves we had? People have gone broke. People are going without food to pay their electric bills because they had to keep their AC running for days on end. People have lost their Medicaid coverage, and most of the people kicked off are actually still eligible. They just live in states that are hostile to the idea of Medicaid itself. So we have people suffering. People who are struggling are rarely get media attention. The Ukraine story continues to get, the media attention it gets is just to repeat the Biden administration narrative. There's no questioning allowed. No one's allowed to tie these expenditures for Ukraine with the needs of people at home. And of course, along comes a Trump indictment to seal the deal and divert people's attention away from these important issues that if people looked at, they would question the system, they question the Biden presidency, and so, of course, we get endless Trump coverage.
And let me say, Margaret, that if you find yourself held captive another time, message me. I will always come to your rescue. You write in your piece, the word democracy has been elevated to sacred status of late, and its use and overuse are an indication that many people are protesting too much. Speak to that, because there are those who would say, we don't see enough, and that could just be the media hiding it, but we don't see enough protest that if there was more protest, there could possibly be change. Margaret Kimberly.
Yeah, the word democracy, I guess ever since January 6th, 2021, there's constant talk of democracy, defending democracy, could lose democracy, Trump's a threat to democracy, 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 over and over again. And that is projection, and that is protesting too much. And the point is that we don't really have that. Now, you have this person who can be a useful foil, and you can point at him when, yes, we have elections, but the candidates are chosen well ahead of time. The people don't have any input. You have a President Biden who breaks the railroad worker strikes, but now runs around calling himself the union president. We don't have democracy. We don't have the people do not have a say. Rich people and corporations, the oligarchs of both the wings of the duopoly run the country. We don't have democracy, but that's why they keep saying it, because it's another form of distraction and diversion. And so that's why this word has taken on this new meaning, that it's, you know, elevated, as I think I said, sacred status, because it's part of the scam. It's what is needed to divert attention away from the serious issues that political leaders do not take care of, because that's not why they're in office. They're not in office in order to address the needs of the people.
That was Margaret Kimberly, editor and senior columnist at Black Agenda Report and author of Prejudicial, Black America and the Presidents. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Seltzer, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison, with support from Freddy Heredia. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.